Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This week, we're excited to bring you a conversation with Rachel Bovard of the newly created Internet Accountability Project, or IAP. IAP's mission is to lend a conservative voice to calls for federal and state governments to rein in the power of big tech. She's also the co-author of a new book titled Conservative, Knowing What to Keep, which she wrote with Senator Jim Dominion.
Rachel brings more than a decade of policy experience on the Hill to the emerging tech debate on the left and the right. Now, we know it's easy for these kinds of discussions to get bogged down in the weeds of wonky jargon and acronyms, so we tried to focus our questioning around a central question. What do all the debates about big tech actually have to do with the average American consumer? To better frame how we talk about these issues, we created a character for the week's show. Meet Brenda. Brenda is a suburban housewife. She might live in the Midwest or rural swing state. She's a baby boomer or a Gen Xer who uses Facebook to keep up with the news and her family. She might have an Amazon Alexa in her house, and she might email using a Gmail account or an operated smartphone. Brenda's our mom or our mom's friend. Basically, we're all very familiar with her.
With Brenda as our guide, we'll seek answers to questions like, is Alexa listening to her conversations in her home? What kind of data are Amazon, Facebook, Google, and others gathering about her? Are we living in a technological gilded age? And whether or not state governments and Congress need to rethink the laws that govern the way social media companies operate. Let's get to it.
Rachel Bovard, thanks for joining The Realignment.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so the reason that we wanted to have you on is you're accomplished Hill staffer. You've worked at the Conservative Partnership Institute with Senator Jim DeMint. But you recently started this new organization, the Internet Accountability Project. It's one of the new organizations on the right built to, I guess, check the power of social media companies. And that is something that we've focused on a lot about at this podcast, the intersection of technology and politics. One of the things that really hampers the debate over big tech and our society is kind of the inaccessibility of this discussion. And we wanted to talk about this agenda on the ground, the experience of an actual conservative consumer in mind. So let's begin the discussion from a framework of the archetypal suburban mother. Her name is Brenda in a Midwestern state. She uses Facebook to keep up with the news. She has an Alexa device in her home. She has the latest iPhone and maybe the latest iWatch. She uses Google for Gmail. You focus on privacy, antitrust, and Section 230. These are all things that we're going to get in here. But why is it that these companies that you list here are a threat to the daily life of this consumer?
Well, I think for Brenda in particular, she's getting a lot of convenience from these products, but I think gone unsaid in the exchange is that Brenda is a commodity. Mm. And Brenda's data is being commoditized, oftentimes without her knowledge or her consent. And I think that is a really big concern for everyday Americans, because what goes along with that is this whole bastion of other things, right? Not just your data being used and trafficked by these big social media companies for ad revenue and sold to outside users, but also the numerous bad acts, is what we call them, that this allows to proliferate on the internet under the guise of Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. Everything ranging from Facebook populating pages for ISIS extremists, or drug trafficking running rampant on these platforms, or even the New York Times reporting recently about the 18 million reports of sexual assault gone basically unnoticed and unmonitored by these tech platforms. Mm. So all these things, I think, are really integral to someone like Brenda, but they aren't getting a lot of traction. To your point, this is sort of an inaccessible conversation, not just at the neighborhood day-to-day level, but I think also at our politics as well.
Absolutely. So, two things. One, can you sort of define big tech? Because funnily enough, we sort of talk about Silicon Valley, but oftentimes these companies aren't even in Silicon Valley. And the other thing we've noticed is that in a lot of the reporting on your group, Apple and Microsoft are rarely mentioned. So what sort of distinguishes sort of the companies that are perceived as being good for privacy, bad for privacy, commoditizing users, et cetera?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think we would define big tech as anything that commoditizes users' data in a way that may be unknown to them. But I think in a lot of our popular parlance, it comes down to the social media companies because they're the most visible threat to it. Mm-hmm. But I do think, to your point, Apple and Microsoft have a very big role to play here as well. And, you know, we want to talk about all those things. We want this to be an encompassing conversation across the spectrum. But, you know, from my perspective personally, I do think the political conversation right now is really focused on Google, on Amazon, yeah, antitrust, you know, Twitter, Facebook. And so that's where I think a lot of the public conversation is taking place.
And so on this privacy note in particular, one of the things that we've seen consistently in a lot of polling is that privacy is not actually the number one concern that a lot of people have, particularly these consumers who, you know, they might be commoditized, but they don't appear to mind their commoditization. So how is this, you know, our archetypal Brenda, how is she supposed to experience the privacy critique?
Yeah, try to make it relevant to Brenda. I think it's a reasonable question. You know, I think part of it is that Brenda's operating in a knowledge, it's an unequal playing field in what she knows about, right? I find this a lot with the libertarians who argue with me. And let me just put it out there. I love the libertarians, right? I'm a former Rand Paul staffer. Like, I kind of came up with these guys. But what really frustrates me about their argument is this idea that, like, oh, well, you're an equal player in the exchange. You know what's going on. When you consent to have your data, you know, when you use this device, you consent for them to use these things. But in many cases, you do not. And I think that's the issue that we're trying to get at right now and that Brenda really needs to understand is that she may not have a Facebook account, but Facebook is tracking her across the internet. She may use Google and put her privacy settings on high. Google is still tracking her across the internet and using that data accordingly. Mm-hmm. So these are things I think that are not as well understood at the neighborhood level.
Sure. So let's go sort of down two different lines. So firstly, what does it mean to be commoditized? Because we're losing that word a lot. So like when Brenda's commoditized, like what does that mean in the context of Amazon?
Yeah. So basically it's companies taking your data and building you targeted ads around it. And it's not just the data for what you buy, what you look at on their platforms, but what you look at on other platforms, right? If Facebook tracks your IP address, so even if you're logged out of Facebook, they're still watching what you're doing, you know, on different websites, what you're buying, and then they're sharing that data with other advertisers. And so that's kind of what I mean by commoditizing. And I think to the point about, you know, why should Brenda care? I do find that a lot of the people who say they don't care about Facebook tracking you care about the NSA tracking you.
Yes.
And NSA has far fewer, you know, gigabytes, terabytes of data on you than these private companies do. So that's something I think that should be discussed.
So to be fair to our libertarian friends, I'm sort of guessing what they would ask you. They'd say, well, Amazon can't kick down your doors and arrest you and put you in chains.
Well, I will say there was a report in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago that Ring is now partnering with which is owned by Amazon.
Which is the doorbell company.
Which is the doorbell company owned by Amazon is partnering with local law enforcement. And so to get into sort of crime enforcement. So I think we are actually moving into a territory where there's a cross nexus between surveillance, capitalist surveillance, and law enforcement.
Right. But left unsaid in a lot of this, when we talk about targeted advertising, it's easy to make it nefarious, but it is the best way to deliver ads.
Yeah.
It is the best way to actually deliver a good consumer experience on Amazon, on Facebook, on Google. Like a lot of the times, the reason people don't mind their data being used in this way is because they kind of like the product they're being received. So is the project as you see it to tell these consumers that there is a downside, that there is no such thing as a free lunch whenever it comes to these things?
No, I think you've really hit on it. And I think it's important to point that out. I am totally fine with the innovation in this space. I think the social media companies and Google and, you know, all these actors have done amazing things for our society. And I don't have any intention of trying to clamp down on any of that. Mm-hmm. However, I do think there's a case to be made that our public policy is not fully kept up with the pace of innovation in this space and to be able to make this an accessible conversation. Because right now, when you try to talk about this in Washington or anywhere, you are shouted down and told that you are a statist and how dare you want to control a private company. And I think we've moved far beyond that. That is a far too simplistic way to look at this problem. Mm-hmm. And so I do want to talk about that in particular, because like you said, ads work, right? And there's a lot of money in this space and we like it, right? There's a reason a lot of people don't use DuckDuckGo. And it's because they're not collecting your data. So the ads and the search.
And DuckDuckGo is a browser.
That protects your privacy. I do use DuckDuckGo for the record. It's terrible.
It's not collecting your data, right? It's not, the search results aren't as good because your data is not being collected. So there is an upside to it. But again, people don't understand. And the companies, I think, grossly take advantage of that lack of comprehension by the consumer. You saw this in a really clear exchange between Google and Josh Hawley in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he basically called them out and said, so you're telling me that I, as the consumer, I put my privacy settings on high and I think you're not going to track me. Google says yes, but you track us anyway. Google says yes. And so that's something I think needs to be more of a discussion.
Because what I'm hearing here is there should be more of a balance, right? So once again, the reason why Facebook's free for users, they have this sort of tagline somewhere on their website, Facebook is free and always will be, is because they sell ads. Right. They commoditize the user. So what... I don't want to live in a world where I have to pay for Facebook. So what does a moderate sort of balanced sort of interaction look like?
Well, I think that's the big unknown, right? And I think what IAP, my group, wants to do in this space is to allow that conversation to happen. Because right now you're dealing with two things. You're dealing with the fact that this is sort of an untouchable object on the right, right? You can't talk about regulating these private companies because private companies, like somehow that's enough. But the second is that there's not a really big understanding of how this process actually works. And you saw this, you see it every time Mark Zuckerberg comes for a public hearing. You see people like Orrin Hatch, obviously not now retired, but at the time being like, what is an ad?
Right.
You know, so yes. I think there's a serious lack of understanding. And that, I think, needs to be addressed by a public conversation and a transparent conversation from these companies about how their products actually work.
So to your personal history, you know, you said you were a Rand Paul staffer. When did you first start considering these free market government intervention debates differently? Because I think that's the thing. We talk about this on the podcast. That's what's changed the most over the discourse. 2013, this was not a conversation the right was having.
No, and I think, you know, that's very true. And I think really what did it for me was when I was in the Senate working on the USA Freedom Act, which you may recall passed in 2015, it limits what the government can collect via metadata on individual citizens.
And what's metadata?
It's, you know, the bulk amounts of, the vast bulk amount of data that collected on every American citizen, and then the NSA would then, you know, peer through it seeking what they wanted. We put parameters around what the government was able to do. What I never could understand, what I still do not understand now, is why some libertarians are perfectly fine with the amount of that data being collected, and it's okay simply because it's a private company. That is not enough of a threshold test for me. I don't know what the answer is, right? I don't want to shut down Facebook. I don't think Facebook's inherently evil, but I do think it's a very reasonable domain for policymakers to say, look, this has changed our culture. This has changed our political discourse. We have huge unaccountable corporations awash in billions of dollars controlling our access to our conversation in unprecedented ways. Maybe it's okay to talk about
it. Right. And in terms of this discussion, I think part of the resistance from the libertarian right on this is that it is very easy to fall into the traps that are perpetrated by some of the way that the far left would approach this. So they would say, not only should we break up Facebook shouldn't exist, and you know, we should impose levels and taxes and all these other different things so that such that it would be almost impossible for any sort of competitor to rise again in the first place. How do we have the discussion in a way on the right that is fundamentally different about concerns about technology than from the concerns of the left?
Yeah, well, it's working within that framework. Because like, as you pointed out, the left's diagnosis for everything is burn it down.
Yeah.
It's not working, burn it down. And the right says, no, actually, we just want to see what's worked before, what's not working now, where we can tweak a little bit in a way that protects the market and protects the innovation of the space, because that's what makes America a leader here, but also protects the needs of the consumer and the needs of the privacy advocates and things like that. And so there isn't anyone striking that balance right now. Josh Hawley is the first person. Marsha Blackburn is also taking steps in that direction. But you're seeing hell rain down on them for it. And so I think my group really wants to rebalance that and say it's okay to have this conversation. No, we don't want to, you know, burn down the social media companies. But whoa, let's pump the gas. Or I'm sorry, pump the brakes. We've been pumping the gas. And say, you know, maybe let's take a second look.
Well,
So an interesting idea you guys actually speak about on your website is you want to transition to a world where there's a market for consumer data. What would that look like? And what does that even mean?
Yeah. Well, it starts with people actually knowing how much data is being collected and how it's being collected and the companies being transparent about it. Because right now, you know, there is not, I think personally there's a property rights angle involved in your data, right? When you look at the exchange, right? We get on Facebook and it's free. Facebook gets access to us. But they can cut us off from our data at any point. And look
how
at,
so?
Well, look at a user like Alex Jones, for instance. Uploaded millions of dollars worth of content to YouTube, to Twitter, to Facebook, was making these platforms millions of dollars and then simply was cut off from access to it. They kept the value he gave them, but he got nothing. And so is there a property rights discussion to be had there. And I think that's where that discussion would
What's
start.
What's fascinating about that point is that's a different question from, does Alex Jones have to be allowed on Facebook? Yeah. Which is the question about the bias and a question about censorship. But what you're saying is that there was still an exchange, and it's all just gone.
Well, taking the censorship thing out of it and just simply saying this is a contract to some extent, and these companies may be in breach of that contract if they have terms that are enforced selectively, right? And if they're non-transparent about it, that is just blatant contract law violation. And so from that angle, I do think there's a property rights discussion. The censorship thing is a totally different
and
thing.
And bringing this back to the consumer, I mean, the way that a lot of the consumer has digested the discussion around big tech is about bias and about censorship. So what is the way that IAP thinks about conservative bias or conservative censorship?
Well, we definitely think it exists. Yeah. And I think anybody who isn't taking it seriously just isn't a serious player in this conversation. I mean, you just saw Mark Zuckerberg come to the Hill and tell Josh Hawley, yeah, we were biased against Live Action, the pro-life abortion group that got censored from Facebook. He said that was a clear evidence of bias. And this is sort of a central question. Who is going to govern our discourse? And that is an unknown, right? And I think there is not a good balanced conversation about that on Capitol Hill. And I think there's a lot of people in this country, myself included, who think there should be.
So the next section that you all really worked on is the conversation around antitrust. So firstly, like sort of what is like antitrust policy in this context?
Well, I mean, based on the federal definition, you know, we prove consumer harm. That is our U.S. definition of antitrust. You've seen the European standard be applied over, you know, across the pond, which focuses on business harm, which is a little bit different. But are consumers being harmed in the sense of choice?
And isn't it usually consumers, and this is where there's a lot of debate on the right. Yeah. It's like consumers are harmed because this monopoly is charging them more money. But what's interesting here is it's not like a pricing thing because Facebook's not charging anyone.
Well, remember, Microsoft, the antitrust investigation in Microsoft changed the game on that because it focused on the fact that Internet Explorer was free.
Right.
With all of the products that Microsoft sold.
So this is during the late 1990s.
The late 1990s, and that's going to, I think, provide a lot of precedent for if there's an antitrust, a formal investigation launched into these
companies.
That's
the very interesting part here, right? Which is because we discuss Amazon, and Amazon is preferencing its own manufactured goods over those of others, but they are cheaper. Mm-hmm. And so how is it that we can prove a consumer harm if fundamentally they're getting a cheaper product?
Yeah.
What is the downstream effect that is affecting? Because, you know, when I search on Amazon, and I suspect the average consumer, I like having cheaper products.
No, same. Look,
we do too. Yeah.
Jeff Bezos basically owns half my paycheck, right? It just goes straight into Amazon. But, you know, I think a lot of this comes down to consumer expectation, right? And the issue with Amazon right now is that its algorithms are prioritizing its own products. So the consumer's actually not even getting necessarily all the information about what's the cheapest product. Mm-hmm. And Amazon has some proprietary ability to say we should promote our own stuff. But if it's then alleging it's giving you the cheapest prices when it's not, I think that there's a case to be made. Yeah. Again, let me just clarify, not an antitrust attorney.
Right. But, yeah. I mean, I don't think we absolutely have to be antitrust attorneys because ultimately, if we look at this as the way Amazon is doing this, is they're using their highly profitable server rental business, Amazon Web Services, to subsidize retail. Now, the question is whether that is anti-competitive behavior. And I'm not sure that, I mean, this is very much a new discussion that we're having because no modern business in the past, or no business in the past would ever have been able to do something like that before.
And this is actually a good time to take a step back, because something that was so interesting on y'all's website was you talked about how you referred to our current era as a modern and gilded age. Yeah. And you sort of positively cited the experience of America during the 1910s and 1920s, when there's a lot of discourse around antitrust. And fascinatingly, you positively cited Theodore Roosevelt, which as someone on the right, you know that very much is not a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
George Will came on this show for our first episode. He was not happy with President Roosevelt. So can you sort of talk about how you look at the history of this sort of issue?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, you bring it up because sometimes I think the right looks at any sort of government action in the business space as just awful. Like, you can't talk about it. It's unprecedented. It doesn't happen. Well, it does happen. Reagan did it. You know, Roosevelt, we can totally go up and down about whether Roosevelt's a good example to use.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm probably closer to George Will on that. But, you know, but he did do it, right? Yeah. And the companies, it's interesting because the tech companies now, there's an argument to be made that they've actually benefited from it, right? Reagan broke up Ma Bell, and we got iPhones.
Yes.
You know, there's obviously that's a very broad correlation I'm making, but there is a thread to pull there. And the same with Microsoft. You know, the government sort of investigated in this space. It changed the way Microsoft did business. It allowed other companies to flourish in this space. Is it always the answer? No. You know, and it may not be the answer here. Mm. But I think our point is to say there is a remedy here. And to your point that we have never even dealt with problems like this before, our public policy needs to catch up.
Yeah.
It needs to a moment to take a breath and say, we are awesome. Look where we found ourselves. Mm. Whoa. You know, do we need to intervene here?
And that's the thing is when we discuss about this as a Gilded Age, I mean, the previous Gilded Age, the reason that the populist resentment against that arose was because fundamentally billions of dollars were being extracted at the expense of poor working conditions. You know, people were living in poverty, the inequality gap. That does exist. However, it is a different situation because it's not like, you know, our archetypal Brenda is not actually, she's not suffering. Mm-hmm. And so is it appropriate, I guess, to compare it to a modern Gilded Age when the consumer harm isn't necessarily as explicit as it was at that time?
Yeah, you know, it's not physical toil, right? It's not, you know, extraction of wages and all these
things. Unless you're an Uber driver.
Right. Actually, now that we're going to get into the gig economy, whole other Pandora's box.
Yes.
But, you know, that definition may have changed. And that's why antitrust may not be the right remedy. I don't know.
Okay.
But I'm completely comfortable with the idea that we can say there may be a place of, you know, of consumer harm. It may look different now. And your data exploitation may be a new area. Mm. And I think it's totally appropriate for policymakers to say, hey, I'm curious about that.
Yeah.
So you've referenced the Reagan era a couple of times, and you also have said that the antitrust movement was sort of hijacked by crony capitalists sort of 40 years ago. I'd never really heard that before. So two questions. One, what is crony capitalism? And then two, what actually happened 40 years ago?
She's like, oh, let me put my libertarian hat on. Yeah.
See, well, we're mixing it up. There's a lot of different hats we're wearing tonight.
Well, you know, crony capitalism you can define it in a lot of ways, but basically it's business working with the government in their own interests. So business coming in to regulate, you know, on behalf of basically regulating themselves, you know, via the government. And my concern in particular with the tech companies is that you're starting to see this now a little bit with tech companies at the table writing their own regulations. And I, for one, have a huge problem with that. There's been privacy legislation discussions going on in the Senate Commerce Committee for like the last 18 months. There's not really a big product coming out of that yet. But guess who's at the table? Google. You know, that's, to me, that's a big example of something that should not be happening. It might not fit the exact definition of crony capitalism, like, you know, the U.S. taxpayers funding Boeing, but it's getting pretty close.
And what's so interesting about that is that every once in a while, you sort of hear a tech CEO say, we welcome regulation. So it's like, and that's sort of, you sort of touted in the headlines as this big thing.
Yeah, basically they're saying, we welcome the regulation that we will write ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a huge problem for anyone interested in getting meaningful legislation in this space, if we get legislation at all. Google and Facebook and the tech company should not be at the table.
Yeah. Rachel, one of the things you've worked on legislation, you've helped pass legislation. How is it that, one of the things to this point I've noticed is that there's actually not a lot of institutional knowledge on the right, or frankly, within the Senate or within the Congress
Everyone's guilty.
On technology, on antitrust, and that's why they turn to Google, because it's so complicated and it's such a new emerging field. What is it that your organization is going to do to foster that? This is an institutional thing, but a lot of people should care about this because this is how policy actually gets done.
Yeah. That's the transparency argument. Yeah. Like it's incumbent upon these companies to be far more transparent than a, you know, 50-page 0.5 font consent agreement that they give to users. Like that is insufficient, not only for the user, but it's insufficient for the policymaker. And so I do think encouraging this kind of dialogue, you know, I don't think any users or politicians were aware necessarily that Google kept tracking you even when your privacy, you know, notifications were on. That is something new that came out of a Senate hearing. More of that should happen, and more attention should be focused on that. And the lawmakers that want to engage in this space and just ask questions shouldn't have hell rain down on them from the right for being regulators,
and
curious people.
It's hard for a lawmaker to hold a hearing, though, when they don't really know what to ask. Because to your point, in some of the past hearings that we've had, asking Mark Zuckerberg how he makes money is not, I'm going to posit here, not the greatest use of the five-minute questioning period. So what is it that your organization is going to be doing, I guess, in order to educate lawmakers a bit better so that they can ask the right questions?
Yeah. I think there are a lot of privacy groups that are not funded by Google, that work in this space, that actually have a ton of knowledge. And I think sort of getting them together, right? They've been working in these little islands for a long time. I think getting them together, getting them to the Hill, getting them in front of lawmakers, and getting the staff in front of lawmakers. Because like it or not, you know, I'm a millennial, but I'm an old millennial. I'm like, you know, 84, so I think I'm right at the cutoff. Uh-huh. I didn't have Facebook until I was a senior in college.
Right.
You know, that is doesn't make, you know, make me an expert by any means, but I think the younger generations who grew up with it are a lot more fluent in this space. So I think getting the staff up to their level is mm-hmm. important as
Absolutely.
Well.
So are there any concerns that we're sort of just fighting the last war? So when we're
Before
thinking,
the robots take over.
Yeah, of course. So when we're thinking of the Microsoft case, right? Microsoft basically escaped scot-free in 2000 after the antitrust case. And then guess what happened? You know, Google came about. Apple rebounded. Microsoft actually lost the entire next 10 or 11 years, and they're recently just coming back out of that. So if we're talking about regulating Facebook, are we sort of in danger of missing sort of the future innovation that's actually coming down the line?
I think it's a legitimate fear and something I want to protect against in these conversations. I think it's really important. But I'm a little bit more optimistic, I think, because, you know, I see these conversations from a regulatory perspective and like a federal policy perspective. That's one side of the conversation. But the other side of the conversation, and that I think, you know, as a society, we're sort of waking up to it. I think this is going to govern us going forward, is these are questions about how we should live together. Mm-hmm. The more that social media and the tech companies control our interactions, control our conversations, control what we do during the day, this is far less of a conversation about laws and more of a conversation about society and what we're willing to tolerate as a society. Do we want to allow massive sex trafficking and exploitation and human misery online? Or do we want to engage a little bit more on these platforms? Do we want more transparency and access to our own data as a property right, or do we not? You know, there are going to be federal policy questions involved in that, but this is much, much more of a conversation for Brenda, in my opinion, than it is for someone in the Senate.
I think you're right, and I think this is a structural conversation because this really does mimic kind of the early 1900s discussions around the First Amendment when fast media is first coming upon the board. What we're talking here fundamentally is about the public square, what's allowed in the public square, what's not. But what's different here is that the public square is not controlled by a government authority in this particular case, and they're not the ones that are adjudicating what can be said and what can't. And this, this is what probably extends the most into the libertarian discussion, which is, what is the appropriateness of the government role in talking about what's allowed in the public square?
And this, I think, is new territory to some extent, because we've never had our public square controlled or manipulated by algorithm this much.
Yeah.
And so what
is... It's not human. It really isn't.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what, you know, how do you go about that? And I think for the libertarians, my frustration a little bit with trying to talk to them about this is they're like, well, it's a private company, so it's fine. But I posit that we may have gotten to the point where these private companies, when it comes to speech, are a bigger threat than the government is in that mm-hmm. space.
Yeah.
Now,
so
I'm not saying that they can kill you and knock your door down, but I'm saying in the speech space, right, you know, there has to be, I think libertarian policymakers are naive if they think somehow this is appropriate, what's going on.
So this is actually a good sort of pivot into the last area we all were focused on, which is the Section 230 debate, which is this very obscure but also incredibly relevant area. So firstly, what is Section 230?
Basically, it's the part of the federal law that allows these companies to be not held liable for what is posted on their platform. They're not publishers. They're simply a platform. And so they don't get dinged when, you know, ISIS recruits on Facebook mm-hmm. because they're just the platform. They're not the editorial controller. So they're not subject to the same laws as like a newspaper.
Mm-hmm. So this came out of a law in 1996 at the start of the internet, right? When you had...
I mean, the internet barely...
fair.
It was like AOL chat rooms. It was really what it was written about. Was so that AOL was like, they have all this content, a lot of which is, you know, bad, and they don't have the ability institutionally in order to deal with this. Yeah. Why is this relevant to an average consumer?
Well, because this gets into the censorship issue.
Brenda has a name, Sagar.
Yeah. Hello, Brenda. We hear you. You are seen.
Yes.
You know, this gets into the censorship question, but this gets into the sort of human exploitation that goes on online and who is responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it the user or is it the platform? And should the platforms be doing more to control this? And it crosses a number of different issues when it, you know, it is probably the biggest issue when it comes to like whether or not the federal government should weigh in the tech space. And I think, you know, there are a number of ways to address this. You know, Josh Hawley, we keep coming back to him because he's the only one that's really acting here, but he's put out a bill that, you know, the people on the right or on the libertarians and the right say, look, this is too much of an anti-state. They may be right, but I think the impetus behind what he's trying to do is say, look, this law that was written in 1996, when I was still spending 7 hours burning a dial-up CD, you know, like, doesn't reflect our modern reality? And is it okay to actually talk about how this should be updated? And that's something that, you know, IAP, we haven't put out a specific policy solution because I don't think we know what it is.
Yeah.
But we want to be able to talk about it again in a rebalanced space, you know, where people can be on both sides of that argument.
I think one of the best arguments about this is that what Hawley and a lot of the other people who want to at least question Section 230, what they say is that this was a boon to these social media companies, that they have essentially built these large commoditized businesses on the back of lack of need to police the content on their platforms. So if we're going to grant this special privilege to a publishing organization, which is what they would call them, then they need to step up to the plate and engage on the public level. They don't get to live totally for free.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also worth pointing out that people who are saying, well, this is totally private, the government isn't involved. The government is involved.
Right.
Like, to your point, Section 230 is a sweetheart deal to some extent.
It is.
They are benefiting from a very specific government regulation. So to pretend the government's not already involved here and doesn't have a role, particularly when it comes to that CDA, the Communications Decency Act, is a fallacy.
Right.
So how would... How do you still, and this is difficult because like we're just, this is why it's a fascinating area, because all these conversations are so nascent that I can't expect you to say this is exactly how this would look like for Brenda, let's play devil's advocate for Facebook. Facebook has billions of users. The thought is that to hold them liable for individual postings that are made would basically fundamentally destroy their business model. It would prevent basically anyone from, not just Facebook, just anyone hosting platforms of large people. So what does balance, because I think we want to return to balance, right? So what, if we could argue that things went a little too libertarian, what does a sort of more centered consensus look like?
Yeah, I'm going to be a disappointing guest because I don't have the answer to that. But I think your point is well taken. Like, basically making them liable for, you know, billions and billions of posts, like, that is just incomprehensible. It's not something I don't even know that they could do. But I think what we are suggesting, you know, in IAP is simply that there is some kind of middle ground here. But at the very least, these conversations need to be happening in a way that, you know, reflects, you know, what would be the burden on the company, but what is also the burden on the consumer and the millions of people who are exploited online every year, you know, the drugs that are trafficked, you know, the privacy that is violated, that those are concerns too. And so how do you best reflect both of those? Because right now the conversation has swung so far to the libertarian right that, you know, it's simply like you can't even talk about it without being declared a statist.
I think that's the most interesting part here, which is, you know, back in 2011, Obama was giving a State of the Union saying that Facebook and Google are national champions. Uber was considered one of the darlings of the right and a triumph of American entrepreneurial capitalism. So you've worked here for a while. What changed in those interim 5 years on the right specifically that he's even allowed the creation of your organization?
Yeah, I do think that it's starting at the grassroots to some extent. You know, I do think Brenda may not know all of the details here, but has a sinking feeling that maybe Alexa's listening to her when she's, you know, having a private conversation, and maybe that's not cool. You know, and I think also the bias and the censorship, and this is starting to wake people up. And so I do think that voters are always smarter than we give them credit for. And I do think there's a general unsettledness in the American population about how much control and data people have, these companies have over our lives, and a general starting understanding of the fact that surveillance, be it corporate surveillance or government surveillance, may not be the best idea. And so you're starting to see that reflected, I think, in some of the policy views that are popping up on Capitol Hill. I really do think this has its roots in the American people themselves. And again, it's why I go back to the fact that this is a federal policy conversation, but so much of it always comes back to how are we going to live together? And that's, I think, the biggest discussion that has to be meted out.
And speaking of living together, the thing we haven't talked about is the left. Not even just the left, it's basically mainstream Democrats. How, because what's so interesting about most of this discussion, you, other than our references to the libertarian right, this is a very ideologically neutral conversation. It's about consumers, like basic how they interact with the internet. How has the left been receptive to this message? Because I think something that we've discussed in previous episodes is if you frame this just along the lines of Alex Jones and conservative bias, it means that by definition, you can't have a broad consensus-based articulation. There's a completely secular case for a lot of these discussions.
No, I think that's right. And I think it's, the left has been very reflexive on this point, as they are on a lot of things. You know, if it's not working, destroy it. If it's not working, break it up. And so it's a little bit, I think, hard to have the nuanced conversation that you want to have on the right, because you want to protect the free market and you want to protect the innovation, but you also want to balance these concerns. But I do think the left has very significant points when it comes to privacy, when it comes to data collection. We saw this when we worked on the USA Freedom Act and curtailing it at the government level. We had a lot of allies on the left, and Patrick Leahy and Judiciary Committee Senate Democrats, who were very interested in that individual component of privacy. And so I do think the left has a tremendous amount to offer on that regard.
Yeah. And what is, I think, the overarching mission for people who are listening and they want to change the conversation? What does that look like? Is it literally just asking the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think it's giving support to people that want to ask the question and not necessarily being like, well, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Private company means they're completely blameless. That is not a non-starter for a totally unnuanced conversation. Mm. So I think appreciating the fact that there is some nuance here and supporting the people who are doing it.
Yeah. I mean, the main thing that we want to focus on, I think, is we want to structure this conversation. So A, how we can live together. But we also want to allow prosperity. We want to allow free market. We want to allow competition. How are you thinking about that part in particular with your organization?
So, I think it's, we don't take a, you know, you can't like big tech approach. Mm. You know, I want to come back to the fact that these companies have changed the way we live in many cases for the better. I think there's a lot of oppressed people in the world who would say Twitter was instrumental in overthrowing governments and changing the shape of the globe. That is unprecedented, and that is good.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we promote the good and control the bad? You can't control the bad everywhere, right? We don't live in a utopia. You can't stamp that out. But I think there is a case to be made that you can act a little bit more, that this rampant sort of allowing the tech companies, allowing these unaccountable corporations to make decisions about what you see and who you talk to and your conversations being controlled by algorithm, that maybe there's a little bit of a problem there.
Yeah.
Actually, this is interesting because I'm thinking, we had Zach Graves on our third episode, and he sort of talked about how tech has to really adjust to the changes on the right here. And I think the recurring theme throughout this episode is we're not speaking libertarian terms. Like, we could reconcile the idea that just as we have to be protected against a powerful government, we also should be concerned about corporate power as well, too. How have you seen tech companies engage with the shifting dynamics here? Do they sort of walk into any meeting with you and assume, well, you used to be a libertarian, so let's just argue about the free market and capitalism?
Yeah, they are scrambling, to put it mildly. Yeah. For a long time, they got away with that argument, especially on the right. They said, oh, well, these guys will protect me because I'm a private business. I'm big business. You don't need to know what we're doing because we're a private company. And that's carte blanche for anything that we want to do.
Well, and the grand bargain they made was that they would be protected by the Democrats because they were socially liberal, and they would be protected by the right because they were entrepreneurial capitalists. And now they're basically being targeted by all sides. One of the things, though, that we haven't talked about here is the national security element to this. I'm curious how and if that fits into the IAP framework, because what we've talked about a lot on this podcast is the China element, is that, you know, many of these companies have a desire to work within China. Google in particular and others have worked or pursued projects with the Chinese government, which are, they use these technological tools as direct elements of an oppressive regime. How do you think that the right, or I guess, generally, should the discussion around national security and technology move forward?
Well, I think it raises a good point in the sense that, we assign a sort of benevolent motive to these companies, right? They're always going to act in our best interests, and they're not going to censor you. Well, Google, to your point, worked with the Chinese government to censor speech and collect data on Chinese individuals that was then passed to the government for 4 years.
Yeah.
And this is something they just did for their corporate bottom line. They were called to account for it and they stopped. But this is the company that's now saying, trust us.
Mm-hmm.
We won't do anything bad with your data. There's definitely worth taking a second look at that for those reasons.
Here's the question, too, is so Google and many of the technology companies, they have come to Washington. They say, listen, we are the best bulwark against China. We are your national champions. We are the U.S. Steel. We are the Carnegie or whatever of the 1890s, and today this is the Gilded Age. Those were companies that which ultimately led us to domination. So should they be required to think of themselves as American companies? Because they don't currently.
Yeah, I mean, this gets into, a policy area that is still ripe for discussion, right? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is there. But I think I know what Donald Trump would say, but
we can guess.
Yeah,
but there is an element to that, and especially when you consider that in every other element of technology, the Chinese are eating our lunch.
Mm.
And so for Google to come and say we're your last best hope, well, that's not very comforting, since we're getting our butts kicked in every other area by China.
Are you guys thinking about other areas? So you mentioned artificial intelligence earlier. Like, obviously, we were making references to Google, to Uber, which relates to self-driving cars. Is that, or are you really just sort of focused on sort of the table that's being discussed today?
No, I think, we could easily have this conversation on anything that's collecting your data and monetizing it and tracking you and all these things. And you know what? Self-driving cars may be the wave of the future, and we may love them, and they may be awesome. But along those lines, I also want to be having a co-commitment conversation about privacy, right? And the data that's being collected and what that data is being used for and who it's being sold to. Mm-hmm. And so those conversations go together. For a long time, we've just been having the innovation discussion as if innovation is good in and of itself, which it is. But there's all these other societal factors and cultural factors and political factors that now need to catch up to our innovation discussion.
So, and my last bit really is, it seems what's so frustrating is how backwards facing this discussion is. So when, you know, Senator Hawley talks with Mark Zuckerberg, over a week ago, it's, you shouldn't have bought WhatsApp and Instagram 5 years ago. So let's say, how do we basically prevent this sort of like 3-5 year lag between government and the tech companies? Because the reality is these companies do grow so quickly. Mm-hmm. They do move so fast that we just have this feedback loop where it doesn't seem like we're going to be able to hold things to account in a balanced way as it's happening.
Well, I think a lot of the discussions happening now are starting to happen on Capitol Hill are good. I think groups forming like IAP are good because it's at least forcing the question into these tech companies, right? It's forcing them to actually think through these decisions.
Yeah.
You know, that they have to now balance competing factors, that not everybody's okay with data harvesting or not everyone's okay with, you know, the fact that our tech industry so much is startups that now want to be bought out. Like, that's their end goal. And is that a free market that we want? So they need to know that they are now inviting scrutiny, not just from the government, but from the consumer.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, going to be a little bit of a check that might be a healthy one.
Well, Marshall and I actually were recently out in Silicon Valley, and we were talking to a tech founder, a very successful one. And they were basically saying that prior to 2014, if you were founding a multi-billion dollar company, you didn't have to think about the government. But that's not really the case that is going forward. Do you think that's a good thing?
It can easily become a bad thing, right? You don't want to hamper that kind of innovation. You want people to be able to know that the free market is there for them, for their creativity to skyrocket. But I think the flip side of that is also true. You know, a lot of the folks I talk to in Silicon Valley, they'll tell you that the market is rife with all these people creating new companies, but literally their end goal is to get bought out.
Yeah.
And that is also not a good thing.
That bad?
I do think it's bad in the sense that, like, you are creating giant conglomerates, you know, and I don't know that that's always healthy in a space where those conglomerates control your speech and they control your data and control all these things. So, you know, it is of concern, I think, that, you know, they worry that their innovation may be hampered. And that's why we have to talk about these things in an open and honest and fair way.
And then to tie a bow on this, so we have our, you know, our archetypal Brenda. What is it about data privacy that she doesn't fundamentally understand from your perspective?
Well, I think she probably doesn't understand that NSA is not the biggest tracker of her. You know, big tech is. You know, I think she may not also understand she's being tracked across every move she makes on the internet, whether she has a Google account, whether she has a Facebook account or not. She may have a private property rights claim to that data that is not being monetized to her benefit, and it's being sold all over the world. And Alexa is definitely listening to you.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, Rachel Bovard, thank you so much for joining the Realignment.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening to this episode. It was a great discussion about why the average consumer should care about the debates around big tech. We hope you share it with your friends and your family members who are looking to understand how these pressing privacy and data security questions impact their everyday lives. And if you want to learn more about the work that Rachel and the Internet Accountability Project are doing, you can see it all at theiap.org.
You can also listen to our previous episode with Matt Stoller of the Open Markets Institute and Zachary Graves of the Lincoln Network, who tackled similar issues from both sides of the aisle. Don't forget to subscribe to The Realignment wherever you listen to your podcast. And we'll see you next week. We'll